5 years ago, Virginians thought about race and race mixing differently than we do now. Then, people of mixed race were often considered to be mongrels of suspicious character and intelligence. Today, the landscape has changed a lot, and people who represent multiple racial categories have risen to prominence in politics, business, academia, and entertainment. But in 1924, a number of prominent Virginians believed themselves charged with enforcing a separation between the races. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we'll examine the Racial Integrity Act and its consequences for Virginia Indians. Today, we're sharing with you a With Good Reason show from 1998 that's the best exploration I've ever heard of the Racial Integrity Act. The program was hosted by Carolyn Elliott.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Elliott. What is race? That's a question the state of Virginia attempted to answer in 1924 with the passage of the Racial Integrity Act. With one stroke of the pen, this law effectively stripped Indians in Virginia of their heritage. And enforcers of the law spent 50 years terrorizing people of mixed race heritage. These were largely disenfranchised, isolated groups like the Melungeons of Southwest Virginia. We'll discuss the details of this act with two experts in a moment. But first, John Blythe filed this report from the Monacan Tribal Center on Bear Mountain, Amherst County, Virginia.
This is another one that got changed from colored to Indian. He was born 1938.
Diane John Shield sits at the kitchen table of her Amherst County home, poring over a large stack of birth certificates and marriage licenses. She's the keeper of records for the Monacan Indian Nation. With her help, tribe members are reversing decades of mistaken identity. They're correcting birth certificates that have labeled them anything but Native American.
This was one that was corrected to Indian. Let's see what it said before. Well, here's the parents of the girl that got hers corrected. It says they're colored. See, it said that she was colored, and we got it corrected to Indian.
So this is someone who was born in 1963, and she was classified as colored.
Mm-hmm. Still happens.
She was born where? She was born in Lynchburg.
Mm-hmm.
At the hospital. Lynchburg General.
Yeah, you go in there with the name Branham and Johns, you pull it up in their records and see what they got. That's what I said, the hit list was there.
The hit list is Plecker's List, an official bulletin sent to county officials in 1943. As Virginia's Registrar of Vital Statistics from 1912 to 1946, Walter Plecker was responsible for records of births, marriages, and deaths throughout the state. His self-imposed mission was to ensure that state records showed only two races of people living in Virginia, white and colored. Plecker believed that because of intermarriage with slaves, there were no pure-blooded Native Americans left in Virginia. His infamous list provided county clerks with the surnames of families striving to pass as Indian or white.
Okay, from Plecker's list in Amherst County, the names are Branham, Johns, Adcox, Tyree, Clark, Southers, Beverly, Duff, Hicks, Roberts, Lawless, Knuckles, Willis, Cash, Terry, Floyd, Wood, and Red Cross. From Rockbridge County, Clark, Polk.
Plecker Floyd, began his efforts Tyree, to remove the classification of Indian from Virginia's records in 1924, the same year the General Assembly passed the Racial Integrity Act. This law made it illegal for those classified as white to marry anyone other than another white. Those who could not prove pure white ancestry were labeled colored. University of Virginia anthropologist Jeff Hantman is an expert on Monacan history. He says that some Indians did intermarry with whites and blacks, but their distinct culture survived. Hantman says Plecker's measures were designed more for expediency than accuracy.
He's one who believes in what has commonly been called the one-drop rule, which suggests that any intermarriage, particularly with people of African descent, African Americans, would make these people African American or colored in the language of the time. Plecker's intent was to create only two kinds of people, white people and colored people. And it made clear how ludicrous segregation was, because if Plecker allowed there to be a third group, a Native American group, if the Racial Integrity Act allowed that, then there would need to be three school systems and three buses and three water fountains and three, and on, or four or five or six.
Faced with the segregation laws that came with being classified as colored, many Monacans left Virginia. Others, like Herbert Hicks, tried to pass.
I'm 55, and my birth certificate said Negro, alias issue.
Thanks to his light skin, as a kid, Hicks could cross the James River into Lynchburg without encountering the name-calling and prejudice that others of Indian ancestry met. At 19, he joined the military as white, but in 1974, he finally began admitting to his Native American heritage. Hicks changed his birth certificate to read Indian in 1993.
You know, I knew basically that I was Indian, and I got to a point in my life that I wasn't going to deny who I was.
Pediatrician Peter Halk met patients with similar stories when he joined a Lynchburg medical practice in the early 70s. Halk noticed that some he examined had Indian features. His colleagues called them issues. The patients themselves were reluctant to discuss their ancestry.
A lot of them had gone through hard times where their families were ostracized and put down as second-class citizens. And so they wanted to forget the past and not be labeled. Now that their life was getting along and getting better, they just soon forget about that.
Slowly, Halk won the confidence of some of his patients, and in 1984, he published the book Indian Island in Amherst County. His book traces the story of the Monacans from prehistory through to the 1980s. Halk's book appeared about the same time that the Native Americans of Amherst County began efforts to restore their identities as Indian. The state, too, has sought to correct the errors of the past. The Racial Integrity Act was removed from the books in 1975. Plecker's Office of Vital Statistics is now called the Office of Vital Records and Health Statistics, and staff there have a procedure in place for those seeking to change the race on their birth certificates. In recent years, Native Americans, as well as Melungeons and others who were incorrectly classified as colored, have requested those changes. In 1997, state lawmakers approved a measure allowing Virginians of Native American descent to correct their birth certificates for free. In Amherst County, I'm John Blythe for With Good Reason.
I'm Carolyn Elliott. As John Blythe said, Native Americans were not the only group affected by the Racial Integrity Act. Many of the Melungeon people of Southwest Virginia look part Indian or part African American or Middle Eastern. Some look white. Most have blue eyes. The heritage of these Appalachian residents has always been a bit of a mystery. So not surprisingly, when Walter Plecker sent out his lists, many Melungeons were on them. Like the Monacans, many left the state of Virginia, but even after they had moved, Plecker hunted them. He sent lists of names to officials as far away as California, warning them to be aware of these, quote, mongrel people from Virginia trying to pass as white. Here to talk more about the Racial Integrity Act and its more than 50 years of enforcement in the state of Virginia are J. David Smith, Dean of the School of Education at Longwood College and author of the book, The Eugenic Assault on America, and Helen Roundtree, anthropologist from Old Dominion University. Her book is Pocahontas's People. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Helen Roundtree, let's talk about Native Americans first. Was John Bly's description of what happened to the Monacan Indians similar to the stories of other Native people in the state?
Oh, most emphatically. Their memories of Plecker were vivid when I began doing my field work in 1970, and they had no kind memories about the man at all. He could affect whether or not they were free to marry various individuals. He could actually stop marriages if Indian people insisted on being registered in those marriages as Indian rather than colored. He could have people yanked out of hospitals, and he did. He had kids yanked out of school systems if they were going to local public schools. I know some Eastern Chickahominy folks that went through that down in Hampton. Literally yanked out during a school day, nice and public, everybody knew it. So when the man has got that kind of power on such a local basis, he can reach out to you from Richmond, you don't forget him very soon.
David Smith, you've studied the history of this. How much of the enforcement really depended on the energy of this one man?
Very much focused in terms of his energy and his what he perceived as his mission. I think he probably thought of himself as a scientist and would probably not have used the word, but also a social engineer. He was very much enamored with the eugenics movement. And this was a movement that supposedly was based on scientific principles, but was very simple-minded in its approach to people, their characteristics, and how those characteristics created social problems. The eugenics movement was in some ways born and nurtured in the United States and in England, and reached its pinnacle, of course, in the race hygiene program in Nazi Germany. And there were many references to American eugenicists, the literature produced here that served as a philosophical basis for what happened in Germany.
Plecker was aware, of course, of what Hitler was doing, and some of Hitler's policies met with Plecker's approval. He wrote this to the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. Your staff member, who had remarked on something Plecker was doing, is probably correct in his surmise that Hitler's genealogical study of the Jews is not more complete than ours in Virginia.
You're listening to a special rerun edition of With Good Reason, originally broadcast in 1998 with host Carolyn Elliott interviewing Helen Roundtree of ODU and David Smith of Longwood concerning Virginia's Racial Integrity Act of 1924.
Is this the only state that takes the eugenics movement this far?
No. There were other states who, North Carolina had laws in the Northeast. There were also very active people, but Walter Plecker was certainly a national figure. He encouraged people in other states to develop laws and to enforce them. He tried to influence the policies, for example, with the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. He was a man with a mission. I think that he perceived the Native American people to be the greatest threat to what he and other eugenicists hoped to find in terms of a more perfectly ordered world with people carefully and neatly separated into racial groups.
Either and black or white. Either. An Indian was a way station, to use Plecker's word.
Exactly.
What does that mean?
The Indian category was a way station for people classified formerly as colored to move gradually into the white category, which was a privileged category.
And therefore he saw people who were classified this way as a threat to this neatly ordered racial separation.
Well, what about the fact that they were of a different race? And I mean, they were a distinct race. I have never understood in this a whole idea of the Racial Integrity Act why they simply didn't have three categories, white, Indian, and colored.
There were a couple of things probably that contributed to that. For one thing, Plecker was primarily interested in Eastern United States populations, although his thinking was reflected as far away as California, which passed similar laws, actually. It was a nationwide sort of movement. But in the Eastern United States, generally, it can be fairly difficult to find full-blooded Indians, and that's what the general public believes it takes to be a real Indian. You have to be a full-blood and look like Sitting Bull. There aren't many folks like that in the East, because so many American Indian populations were early on reduced to small little islands in a sea of aliens, and they had a choice of either committing incest or marrying outsiders, and most of them chose to marry outsiders. So you've got a population among American Indians that really is not Sitting Bull anymore. So that leaves them like sitting ducks, ready for someone like Plecker to move in. Another thing that complicated things in Virginia in particular, and Plecker railed against this in some of his writings, there were some very prominent, politically powerful white families who claimed Pocahontas as an ancestress.
Now, this is the 116th rule that
That's
comes
right.
in.
That's right, and Pokey was not white, you see. So now you've got some fairly muckety-muck people, and they're still here, of course, in the tens
Well, Professor Roundtree, they weren't just muckety-muck people. John Powell, who in 1924, I got this from your book, David Smith, is the one who champions this law being passed, is himself a descendant of Pocahontas. So he's got his own bloodline to be concerned with.
And therefore, the one-drop rule, which they were then putting into law for the first time in Virginia history, had to have an exception. Otherwise, John Powell and a number of other people would have had to start riding the Jim Crow coach. So you have this 1/16th American Indian ancestry that's still allowed, even when everything else is utterly rigid.
Carolyn, I think it's important to to recognize that through the 1924 Racial Integrity Act, there were essentially two races of people legislated into existence, white and other, if you will.
And but the other was called Negro.
Colored.
Colored, okay.
During Plecker's campaign, he had people from the Philippines, for example, or people from other Asian countries classified as colored and therefore excluded from the right to marry a person who was classified as white. By the way, this law and his zeal for it extended even into how people were buried. He monitored the race of people buried in cemeteries in Virginia and insisted on the removal of bodies that didn't fit into the racial category that he felt should apply to a particular cemetery. So is that kind of zeal?
That still goes on in some Virginia communities because I have actually been sent skulls. I'm a cultural anthropologist. I don't do the forensic stuff, but I've been sent skulls that have been found. And I was supposed to establish, number one, are they human? Well, yes. And then, what race is it so we know where to bury it? And this was happening in the 70s and 80s.
Well, let's back up. And David Smith, you've done a history of this in the state of Virginia. So let's take a look at the beginnings of this. Walter Plecker, who has been mentioned here several times, and he has been in his position in charge of the Bureau of Vital Statistics since 1912. How do things change, David Smith, in 1924?
1924 was really a banner year in Virginia for eugenics, if you will. That was the year that the first test case for the right of the state to sterilize someone who was considered to be defective was initiated. This was the famous Kerry Buck case that went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and it was the year that a book was published about the Monacan, people we now know who are the Monacan Indians in Amherst County, but was a book that was entitled, if you can believe this, Mongrel Virginians. And the argument being that these people were defected because they were racially mixed. It really, for me, symbolizes how the eugenics movement had gained such power and taken such a foothold, and how people who subscribed to this philosophy were beginning to engineer what they perceived to be a more pure society.
But what's interesting about this is that the eugenicists in the state of Virginia were working with Marcus Garvey, who, of course, was the champion of keeping the black race pure. So this was going on both sides, and there was great communication and almost friendship between these people, wasn't there?
Yes, John Powell, who founded the Anglo-Saxon Clubs of America and who was a very prominent Virginian, renowned musician and composer, did in fact correspond with Marcus Garvey because they were both pushing for a separation of the races, not so much from the eugenic standpoint. Their collaboration is more from they were looking for social separation. This makes for strange bedfellows often.
Professor Roundtree, this law is passed in 1924, which essentially says you are either colored or you're white. And as you said, the one-drop rule applies. If you've got one drop of colored blood, you're colored. If you have more than 1/16 Indian blood, you're colored. From talking to people in the Indian community, what do they remember? Were they told, did people come in and tell them they had to change their birth certificates, or was when they went to the hospital to have a child? I mean, how did they first become aware of this law?
That's not a question I've asked very many people specifically, but it's come out in some interviews. A lot of the people didn't realize all this was going on until they had to deal with a public agency, and all of a sudden they hit a roadblock. Or they had previously been going to a white hospital where the funding was better and the care was better, and all of a sudden they were denied entrance. They found out about it after the fact in most cases. They were not alerted that the law was going through.
So they found out the Indians found out they were classified as color when they could no longer attend white schools.
That's
you
right.
said no.
Oh, well, they hadn't been allowed to attend white schools before. That sort of segregation had been in since the end of the Civil War. But there had been some public facilities, such as hospitals, that they had been allowed to use. And now they weren't. Or before 1924, these people had been able to marry one another as Indians, and it read Indians in the county court records. And now the clerks were officially having to label them something else and were refusing to fill in I rather than C in the racial box.
And Carolyn, there were Indian people, Native American people in this state in the 40s and 50s who went to Maryland to marry, so they could be married as an Indian couple, who went to other states to have their children born, so that those children on the birth certificate could be listed as Native American or Indian, because they weren't allowed, because they'd been placed on this kind of this hit list, and therefore they weren't allowed to have that identity.
Why was no bond formed between these disenfranchised now Indian people in the state of Virginia who are classified as colored, small groups like the Melungeons, and the black community? They're all suffering from the same kind of segregation laws.
I can answer for the American Indians because I've asked them. I can't answer for the other folks. But there was a very strong feeling among the Indians that even forming this bond and forming a coalition would mean guilt by association. You are associating with people in the black community, and therefore you're going to get labeled even more firmly black. And that was the major reason they were trying to separate themselves even more radically from other non-whites.
It's ironic that there was an Indian school in Virginia at Hampton University, but the Indian people who were taught at that school were from South Dakota and from the West.
Oh, really?
And during that period when Native American people were brought to Virginia to be educated, Virginia was denying that there were any Indians in Virginia.
When does the Racial Integrity Act, when do they start talking about revoking it officially?
The legislative change came in by 1975, when all of the racial definitions were simply repealed. Virginia has always had changing ideas about what constituted white and what constituted colored. And the one-drop rule that became law with the racial integrity law had not previously been quite that rigorously enforced. But as of 1975, Virginia got completely out of the racial definition business. And that was a real first for the place. And after that, then you can't insist that people be classified because you're not defining them anymore.
And how do you assess the ultimate damage that this did to the Native peoples? And are they past that damage now?
50 years later, they still talk about the person of Walter Plecker. They still talk about and have worked very, very vigorously to establish their identity as Native American people. And so it continues. I think for a while there were people who wanted to forget, and now I think we're seeing people who say it's so important that they remember and that this story be remembered, so perhaps we can avoid some of the kinds of mistreatment that those people had to suffer.
I'm still working with people who are liable to go either way on that issue. Sometimes they deliberately don't tell their children and grandchildren about it because they don't want those kids to become paranoid. The major feeling of being Indian in those days, from what I've understood from people I've talked to, was a feeling that the outside world was out there to get you, and Plecker was going to see that it happened. And paranoia is probably not too strong a word in their feelings toward outsiders. And if you know that your kids are going to have to go to public schools, which happened after the 1960s, Indian schools were abolished and you have county schools instead. And you know that your kids are going to get a better education, but that's going to send them out to work with other non-Indians. Then it's best that they don't know too much about what used to go on so that they don't have too big of a grudge and they've got a chance to start afresh. And there are a good many families that feel that way. So there are a fair number of younger folks who are not really fully aware that this sort of thing has gone on.
People may say, well, you know, this is history. This is the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s. It's, as I said at the beginning, an ugly period of history in Virginia. And, you know, why hash it up? But it seems to me, with the new information that we are seeing coming out about genetics, that this is something that could happen again. How far past this kind of thing do you think we are?
Not very. I can answer that real fast. I can answer it real fast.
We find simple solutions to complex problems very appealing. And as we are in the era of the Human Genome Project, and we're mapping genes, when we read those reports of, you know, we're about to discover the gene for alcoholism or the gene for reading problems or whatever, that we find it so appealing. And we could be drawn into that same kind of thinking and that same pull toward an orderly society, a more predictable and controlled society, when that may not be the way we really want to go if we want to, in fact, respect diversity and individuality and the rights of individuals.
Do you agree, Professor Roundtree?
I do. And I would add that we are an even more economically driven society now than we were in the 1920s through 1940s. And we're all aware that when people suffer medical problems and or social problems or combinations thereof, which would be alcoholism, that employers lose money and families lose money. And we're looking for answers, fairly simple-minded answers to those. So if we can isolate well in advance who is liable to show up with these problems and then not hire them, then there's your simple-minded answer. It's going to go on appealing to an awful lot of folks.
I'd like to share just a couple of personal experiences. I recall being in elementary school in Roanoke and having a classmate, another boy, tell me once quite quietly that he was part Indian, but his grandmother said he couldn't talk about it. And I contrast that to a few years ago, I went to the Monacan Bazaar in Amherst County, and during that time we were looking at some literature there and discovered that there was a very distant connection to my wife's family, to some of the Monacan people. And returning from the bazaar, my children in our van were so excited because they were somehow connected to the Indians. They were thinking of themselves as being somehow related to Native Americans. And that, see that contrast in a generation, which I hope will that change will continue.
Thank you both very much.
That was host Carolyn Elliott in a 1998 interview with guest David Smith, the former dean of the School of Education at Longwood University and author of the book The Eugenic Assault on America, and anthropologist Helen Roundtree, professor emeritus of Old Dominion University, and author of the book Pocahontas's People. Virginia's Monacan Indian Tribe is located in Amherst County in central Virginia. On our website, withgoodreasonradio.org, you can see photographs of the one-room Indian school and hear tribal member Karen Wood describe the effects of the Racial Integrity Act on the Monacan people. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the Boar's Head of Charlottesville, featuring special warm-up-to-winter green meeting packages. Additional information available under Meetings and Events at boarsheadinn.com. Come to the Virginia Festival of the Book, featuring authors, illustrators, photographers, and other book professionals, March 17th through 21st in Charlottesville. Visit vabook.org. You're listening to With Good Reason. Elliot Majerzik and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our feature capsules. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. And Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. For a free copy of this show on CD, call 877-451-5098 or friend us on Facebook. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.